Judge Bjorkman, Judge Jessen, Judge Cook, the Honorable Louise W. Bjorkman preside.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, February 19th, 2020. The first case on our calendar for oral argument is the matter of Alan Joshua Waugen, doctor chiropractic license 6076. Counsel, I know you're familiar with our procedures. I'll just remind you that you each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, or relater, I guess it is in this case. And the timing will be indicated in the lights at the podium. It's important you state your name and identify the party you represent, and you may adjust the podium with the button underneath the center to meet your needs. With that, counsel for relater, you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Your Honors, may it please the court. I'm Tom Jensen here for Dr. Waugen. The administrative law judge respectfully found in this case, honorable members of the panel, that Dr. Waugen has something to offer the chiropractic profession. This is from the relator's addendum, page 44. Licensee is very experienced in his field. His interest in scholarly chiropractic research is commendable. Apart from BDS, the complainant, there is no indication of problems with patients. Testimony from three of his patients was positively glowing. There is no dispute that this doctor is a fine chiropractic treater. And what's happened? He was emergently suspended 13 months ago based only on this complaint. He's been suspended ever since. The board has an indefinite suspension on him now. He can reapply to practice with restrictions in 4 years. Then, if he ever wants to return to unrestricted practice, he has to wait another year and pay fines and do other things. I'm fortunate, members of the panel, to represent doctors before the chiropractic board, and we do good things. We have doctors that need to take boundary courses or take ethics classes, pass tests, go to HPSP, and it generally works. But every now and then, the board goes off the rails. It did here. It last did so in one of my cases in 2008. Dr. Curtis Sish is a chiropractor, or was, who practiced in Maple Grove. His opinion appears in Westlaw 2008, Westlaw 4909757. What happened in Dr. Sish's case is that he would sue patients for unpaid bills after they lost their no-fault arbitration or whatever. He would sue them, and they would make complaints saying, we didn't know that we'd have to pay this. And so all these complaints were filed. He was given a 2-year suspension and a $50,000 fine, which is the same thing that happened here, and I'll comment on as well. In the course of the Court of Appeals opinion in Dr. Sish's case, the court ruled that a 2-year suspension was, quote, severe. The panel ruled in 2008 that the 2-year suspension was extreme. And yet, here we are with a doctor whose practice ability is outstanding, is facing 5 or 6 years of suspension, which really is practice ending for a person.
I agree with you that the penalty, your argument with respect to the harshness of the discipline has some appeal. What I'm struggling with is the legal authority to hold one case, the Sisha case, next to this case, which has very different issues, mental health issues, substance use issues, demonstrated boundary kinds of issues, lack of judgment. Those are totally different cases. How do we hold one next to the other and say, yeah, 2 years should have been the discipline here as well?
My answer, Your Honor, goes respectfully to those authorities that we cited in our brief, because What the chiropractic board does is it lists, you know, prior discipline that they meted out that you can review. Interestingly, they've changed that since, make it harder for me to find these prior precedents. But I have a number of them listed in our brief, which I think starts on page 30 for alcohol conduct and prior conduct with respect to sexual misconduct. And these authorities go right through, I think, about page 35.
And I'm familiar with those. I think the board's response to that is that some of those were stipulations in terms. And so, again, it's kind of the apples and oranges comparison. And that's my trouble on that. I mean,
And that's understandable, but it does reflect, Your Honor, respectfully considered judgment of the board and the counsel for the board who are experienced in this practice field, who get a sense of what's, you know, fair and what isn't. And when we have a case where there's no sexual contact but for hugs, if someone wants to view hugs as being sexual contact, there is errors that he made with respect to texts and telling his wife the identity of the patient, her phone number, her appointment schedule, if she was going to come and monitor.
Do you agree that that's unprofessional conduct?
Yeah, that was unprofessional conduct. We acknowledge that these texts and sharing that information with the spouse should not have happened. And he merits discipline. The only reason that we're here is to try to find fair discipline based upon justiciable conduct and the applicable law. We are concerned, as we've raised in our brief, that so much of the background of the relator's relationship with his spouse and his out of clinic conduct, which was bad, went through a bad period, has colored the view of the board in imposing the discipline that they're trying to impose here. I think it just has to shine through.
So what relief are you seeking from this court?
We would ask the honorable court to remand the matter back to the chiropractic board for a reconsideration of appropriate discipline based upon the prior precedence of the board of the licensing boards in board discipline cases. I want to digress on what might be a very small point, too, but it's a poignant point about error that's present here in terms of the remedy. Under the chiropractic statute, section 14810, subdivision 3, a violation is capped at a $10,000 fine. Okay? Now, in Dr. Sish's case, this court ordered that the $50,000 fine meted out to Dr. Sish had to be reduced because the penalty is capped per violation. What happened here? As the Honorable Administrative Law Judge found, there are three violations: engaging in conduct that was sexual in nature, revealing privileged communications, and being unable to practice based upon mental conditions. Three violations. That's $30,000. This court already told the chiropractic board, you got to follow section 14810, subdivision 3.
But do other boards fine like this? It just seems to be a harsh, you know, piling on that I can't recall from my own experience seeing from other boards, like the Board of Medicine or Psychology or Law.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Judge. And I would have to say that I believe that they can. The licensing boards have expenses. I don't know exactly how state budgets work, but they investigate, they do things, their time is diverted. And certainly some financial penalty, I suppose, could act as a disincentive to engage in bad conduct. So I can't say that they cannot do it, Your Honor. I would then like to focus, in addition to the issue, the jurisdictional issue of whether or not this chiropractic board unfairly considered this out-of-clinic conduct. And it is a big jurisdictional issue because can licensing boards discipline us for what I do in my spare time?
But to the extent someone is abusing alcohol and using illegal drugs and having, you know, ongoing relationship kind of issues, I mean, those things do relate to professional performance, or they can. I mean, why is it outside the board's jurisdiction to at least obtain information about things that may be relevant?
Certainly a fair point, Your Honor. If there was record evidence that, in fact, that type of activity came into the treatment room. And once again, there's no evidence of this whatsoever.
Except the complainant, and right? I mean, BDS. I mean, it's her complaint that then opened up all the other investigation. Right?
That's a fair point. I guess I was thinking about alcohol and drug use on that particular answer. So, yes, that's right. I mean, the texting and so forth, the referral to another doctor, yes. But again, I mean, the texting, that's not an issue that occurs outside of the clinic. I mean, the activity outside of the clinic was the alcohol, drug use, the police, the arrest, for which there were never convictions, all of that. That's why I was focused that way, respectfully, on this, Your Honor. Okay, if I could switch to the sexual conduct. I'm sorry, Judge.
Well, my question may relate to that as well. I mean, you're asking us to remand kind of for the board to reconsider this in light of prior precedent. And my question is, shouldn't the board be permitted to reflect, perhaps, arguably, societal values that have changed as far as what is inappropriate sexual conduct or unprofessional conduct with patients? I mean, I think that perhaps they might say, look, what we thought was inappropriate in a boundary crossing 20 years ago has changed from what we would view that today. Why isn't that an appropriate role for the board? And if it is, why should we be bound by what they've done in the past?
Well, because some things don't change. I'd respectfully submit, Your Honor, human sexual interest hasn't changed. So I guess that would be one response. People drink alcohol. Professionals use recreational drugs from time to time. These things happen outside of our professional practices. They're not good if we do that. But again, in terms of whether or not societal change on the subject of sex or alcohol use, I'm not really sure there should be a difference. I think these are things that sort of transcend time.
But one might posit that a patient feeling like a hug,
yes,
was sexual in nature when combined with the text messages, something that perhaps 20 or 25 years ago, at least a lot of people would say, oh, that's not too bad. Today, people might look at that very differently, and shouldn't the board be able to reflect that in their decision-making?
Well, as long as it's bounded by laws pertaining to constitutional rights people have in the property interest in their license, I don't think we should have, you know, jury nullification, and I'm not suggesting, Your Honor, saying that, well, regardless of what the laws say, if society has evolved so this and that is viewed one way differently than it did before. But I do think that in the end we have to remain true to the law on these points, and there are constitutional rights. I will tell you, I love your question because I've cited this UCLA article, and at some point I hope that I can be here and make the argument that some of these two-year blanket absolute bans of conduct between doctors and patients when there's no power differential, these are consenting adults, everybody agrees that it was love. At some point, whether or not that passes constitutional scrutiny, we'll see. So I'll be with you a little bit on societal change. But when we focus on the sexual conduct, you know, my job as a counselor representing someone with constitutional rights, here's a situation where we have to focus. Did what occur here involve sexual conduct? I hope everyone here had a romantic encounter last Friday night. But what happened at the restaurants was not sexual conduct. I respectfully submit that when we apply the laws recognizing his constitutional right evidence with heft that what occurred here fairly can be said to not involve sexual conduct. Secondly, the law prevents doctors from using seduction for patients, and I agree they should not. But again, seduction is not flirting. Seduction is using words and conduct to get someone into bed. There's no doubt about that. And there's no evidence that Dr. Wogan did that with this complainant at all. If I may quickly, on the alcohol use issue, there is a due process violation. The board never had the doctor examined as they must under the statute.
So, I wondered about that statute, and I'm going to ask the board's lawyer about that too. Do you contend that 14810, what is it, subdivision 2, that language is mandatory, or is it directory?
I believe it's mandatory, Your Honor. If you're going to take away somebody's license based upon alleged drug use and don't do the requisite workup, I mean, they hired this Dr. Morgan to give an opinion. And I've given many terrible cross-examinations, but my cross of Dr. Morgan was good. He violated every rule of the American Society of Addiction Medicine in giving that opinion over objection.
Without examining and conducting.
Exactly, Your Honor. And then they have the cop declare over objection that he's an addict. When all the toxicology evidence submitted to the hearing were clean.
How was your client prejudiced by the failure of the board to have him examined?
He's prejudiced because they now declared that he has a substance use disorder based upon that opinion testimony, Your Honor, when the ALJ ruled and the board agrees they did not prove intemperance in the use of alcohol or drugs. They didn't prove it. He's been prejudiced because he's suspended for, it'll be 5 years.
All right, thank you. I see I've taken you over your time.
Thank you very kindly, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tiffany Cedillos. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, the Minnesota Board of Chiropractic Examiners. The Board of Chiropractic Examiners executes its duty to protect the public in part by imposing disciplinary action against licensed chiropractors who violate the Chiropractic Practice Act. The board is asking that you affirm its final order for the following three reasons. First, the board has jurisdiction and authority to discipline relator's license because the evidence in the record demonstrated a myriad of ways in which relator's conduct indicated an inability to practice with reasonable skill and safety. Second, the relator was afforded due process with sufficient procedural safeguards to prevent any erroneous deprivation of the property interest at stake. And third, because the board's order was supported by substantial evidence and imposed appropriate discipline for the conduct.
On the question of appropriate discipline, Relators Council has cited to a number of other board matters in which the board has imposed discipline for in related cases, in cases involving alcohol or other drug use, sexual boundary issues, and nowhere near the discipline imposed in this case. How do we square the discipline here with what the board has done in other cases in a way that doesn't look like we piled on to some of the stuff going on in the relator's personal life?
Thank you for the question. First, I would say that the cases that were presented are a subsection of cases. It's not all the cases that the board has handled. And specifically, the cases that were presented by relator are all settlement agreements. Those settlements were based on facts that came out in negotiation, but not on an evidentiary hearing record like this case. This case involved a two-day evidentiary hearing. It had 12 witnesses, many, many exhibits.
So then are you penalizing Mr. Wogan for invoking his right to have a hearing?
No, we're not penalizing him. I'm just making the point that the record was much more developed in this particular case than perhaps it was in other cases where those cases were settled. And those are the ones that are being offered to the court as comparison. In addition, as Your Honor mentioned, those cases were divided by alcohol and drug use, and then there was a section about sexual misconduct. And in this case, the facts are not the same. We have alcohol and drug use. We have also sexual misconduct. We have text messages where Relator was communicating with the patient saying how he could get around the board's rules and regulations related to sexual misconduct. There was basically many different ways in which Relator engaged in unprofessional conduct in this case that, frankly, the board we haven't seen before. And so those are the differences between this case.
Tell me why you differentiate this to sexual misconduct instead of just misconduct involving boundaries with a patient.
I think it could be said either way. In this case, the boundaries violations were related to seduction, and you know, the statute prohibits generally unprofessional conduct and then enumerates specific things that are considered unprofessional conduct, but it doesn't limit the board's authority to just those things that are enumerated in the statute. In this particular case, the patient BDS testified that there was physical contact that she perceived to be of sexual nature.
That was the hugs, right?
That's correct. She described it as long, lingering, caressing hugs. In addition, the text messages, which, you know, there are thousands of pages of text messages, some of which specifically describe Relator's sexual feelings about the patient while he was performing chiropractic care on her. So for those reasons, I termed it sexual misconduct.
Well, just hypothetically, suppose you have a couple who's decided to save themselves for marriage and they are doing things like hugging and kissing and maybe other things. Is that automatically sexual because they're in a relationship? Or it has only become sexual when it's actually a sex act of some recognized form?
In this case, the context was a patient and a doctor. And the doctor in this case specifically expressed his desire to engage in sexual conduct with that patient. And so in this case, I would say it is sexual in nature, even though all the testimony presented to the administrative law judge indicated that there was no actual intercourse. The statute doesn't require intercourse. It's broader than that. It includes, as Mr. Jensen said, seduction. And in this case, the patient perceived it to be of a sexual nature.
But seduction itself is rather a vague definition, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. I think seduction could mean different things to different people. However,
could be a look.
It's possible. The statute specifically says engaging in any conduct with a patient that is sexual or may reasonably be interpreted by the patient as sexual, or any verbal behavior that is seductive or sexually demeaning to a patient. And again, as I stated, that's not an all-inclusive list of things, but it does give it did give the board a guide in terms of what types of behaviors would be outside of appropriate professional boundaries. In this case, both the patient, the patient testified that she did perceive the relator's conduct as sexual. The text messages themselves are sexual, particularly, for example, a relator sent a nude photograph of himself to the patient. As the ALJ and the board stated in the final order, there's no other reason for a doctor to be sending a nude photograph of himself to a patient other than for a sexual reason.
While we're on the topic of discipline, how do we square the $50,000 civil penalty with the terms of Section 148.10 Subdivision 3?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that that issue is not actually before the court. It was not raised in any of the briefing. However, to answer your question, in this case, There were many instances of violations of the Practice Act, so many instances of unprofessional conduct, much more than five, I would argue. There has been...
But the board found three violations.
They found three violations of the statute, that's correct, based on many instances of violative conduct. And so I would argue that logically it doesn't make sense that, for example, if someone violated the same statute over and over again with many different instances of conduct, that the penalty should be less severe than someone who did one instance of conduct that violated, say, five provisions of the statute. And so that was the case here. There was many instances of particularly unprofessional conduct that warranted that level of a civil penalty. With regards to the mental or physical examination issue, which is in 148.10.1A.12, the board opted to do a temporary suspension of relator's license. You will note that in Minnesota Statute Section 214.077, the statute states that notwithstanding any provision of a health-related professional practice act, when it receives a complaint and has probable cause to believe that there's an imminent risk of serious harm, the board shall issue an order temporarily suspending the regulated person's authority to practice. And that's what happened here in this case. So when the board temporarily suspended relator's license, they had 30 days to have an evidentiary hearing in this matter. And because of that, there wasn't time, basically, to have an evaluation completed before an evidentiary hearing would have been scheduled. That being said, the case was extended several times at the request of the relator, and so more time was built in than normal. And in that case, Relator was able to hire their own expert witness, Dr. Alsdorf, who did a in-person evaluation, met with Relator several times.
But isn't on the board has the burden of proof in a licensing case, correct?
That's correct.
And doesn't forcing a professional to hire his or her own examiner, I mean, doesn't that kind of shift the burden of proof away from the board?
In this case, the board also hired an expert witness, Dr. Morgan, who's an addiction medicine physician.
But he didn't conduct a physical or mental examination, did he, as defined by subdivision 12?
There is no definition of physical or mental examination in subsection 12. The board argues that the examination that Dr. Morgan did would have constituted perhaps a physical examination or a mental examination. He reviewed text messages from the licensee himself. He reviewed recordings of interviews that the licensee did with the police. He reviewed all the records
Did Dr. Morgan ask to meet with Realtor and Realtor said no? I'm just wondering, was there ever a requested of Realtor a mental or physical examination by Dr. Morgan?
No, Your Honor, there was not.
It seems like a mandatory statute to me. I think you're arguing implicitly that it's a directory and that we would have to look for prejudice, but I mean, I don't know how we read the other statute to obviate this requirement. I mean, I know you've talked about the timing thing, but there's nothing in here in 148.10 subdivision 12 that seems to suggest anything but a requirement that the board subject the professional to a physical or mental examination.
Well, I agree that the plain language uses the word shall. It also doesn't specifically say what type of examination would be required, or there's no definition for examination. It doesn't say what the timing of that examination would be. And in addition to that, 214.077 supersedes that statute. It was passed later, and it includes specifically language stating that notwithstanding any provision of a licensing board act, that a temporary suspension can be done. And so we're arguing that 214.077 supersedes that language.
Well, even if a temporary suspension can be done, that's different than kind of the permanent suspension that the board ultimately gave the realtor, right? I mean, I'm just trying to understand your argument here.
That's correct.
Because I understand you're saying, look, you know, you don't have to do this before the temporary suspension, which is, you know, you only have 30 days to do the hearing after that, right? But that doesn't mean the board doesn't need to it doesn't necessarily mean the board doesn't need to do it before they make the final decision on the permanence disposition, correct?
I think that the language in the statute does say shall. I agree, Your Honor, that it does seem to indicate that it's required. However, the timing of the temporary suspension, practically speaking, wouldn't necessarily allow a examination to be completed in terms of getting it contracted, getting it scheduled, and getting it done and a report issued within 30 days would be extraordinarily difficult.
Oh, I've seen government move quickly when they need to. If you could help me with this, if we were to, and I'm not saying that the panel would, but if we were to say, no, you really should have had that in-person examination, and that should have happened, then from the board's perspective, what should our disposition be?
Even if that was a requirement, the board is arguing that it was harmless error in the sense that the evidentiary hearing proceeded. Dr. Elsdorf, who had done an in-person evaluation, did testify and testified specifically that Relator was impaired based on his mental health condition. The standard of proof for the evidentiary hearing was higher than this probable cause standard that we're talking about in the statute, and the board met that standard, or the panel met that standard at the evidentiary hearing. They did prove by a preponderance of the evidence that Relator was impaired and had violated the Practice Act. So because of that, and because the Relator did submit to a mental health examination, granted, you know, to Your Honor's point, at the direction of his own counsel, that expert witness determined, and as did the board's expert witness, determined that Relator was impaired, and therefore it didn't prejudice the Relator. I wanted to go back and just briefly talk about one of Your Honor's questioned about sort of changes over time in terms of how a board looks at sexual conduct or sexting in this case, which I know is not something that I could find very many cases about or, you know, see much in terms of history with our particular board. I think that it is appropriate for a board to have changes in the profession, and that the board members in this case, who are not all, but include professional chiropractic members and members of the public, are able to, you know, judge. They're in the best position to judge the conduct of one of their own professionals, and that's what happened in this case. In conclusion, the board had jurisdiction and authority to discipline Relator's license because a preponderance of the evidence showed that he had the inability to practice with reasonable skill and safety. The Relator was afforded due process, and there was no erroneous deprivation of his property interest. And finally, the board's order was supported by substantial evidence and imposed appropriate discipline. And we request that this court affirm the board's order. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Jensen, you have the last word.
Thank you kindly, Your Honors. I think a good way to look at this particular case in the context of the law that says that agencies should impose their judgment, not their will, that they should not act in arbitrary and capricious manners, is to consider this case as though these were the facts, and they are actual facts. The Relator appeared at work 3 times with alcohol on his breath. 1 time he appeared with a black eye at Woodlands Clinic. He engaged in dumb text messaging with a patient. For 3 weeks, it involved romantic overtures. Shouldn't have happened. He put the patient's chart in a folder accessible on his cell phone, told his wife about her name and so forth. Without any evidence, the wife looked at any chart or made any disclosures by the doctor, who has a psychological profile, who our own experts, and we've been palms up in the case, our own expert shows that with the right cognitive behavioral therapy, with a good therapist involvement with HPSP if needed. He should be able to return to work. Now, in those circumstances, does that merit a 5-year suspension brought on emergently by the chiropractic board? I don't see how it respectfully could. When we look at these prior precedents, and these are just strictly settlement negotiations and so forth that bring these to you, this is the considered judgment of the chiropractic board. We've told you time after time, they let people basically off with state suspension who treat patients with alcohol. They treat patients while on marijuana. They get discharged from HPSP and still work on state suspensions. They're using 8 to 9 drugs while they treat. They have sex with the patient's husband. They have sex with the patients. Nothing comes close to what they've did in this case. So we don't come up here before you too often, but every 12 years, the board needs to be roped back into the law. And this is a case where it's appropriate. They have to be reminded of what this honorable court told the chiropractic board down in 2008. Maybe I'm a naive optimist, old, but I do believe that folks deserve a second chance. Your honorable judges deal with the concept of second chances all the time. Some heinous crimes and so forth, it's different. But this really is a second chance, sort of equitable plea here by a lawyer that if there was any indication the doctor was a bad treater, abused patients, engaged in malpractice, had sex with patients, it would be different. He deserves a second chance.
Mr. Jensen, is there anything in the four corners, if you will, of the board's written decision that you can point to as evidence that the board was exercising its will and not its judgment? I mean, I understand your argument is that the severity of the discipline indicates that, but is there anything else in the decision itself that we could look to show that they're not exercising judgment?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it relates to a goodly share of the entire evidentiary proffer before the Honorable Administrative Law Judge. Calling the police officer for events that occurred at the home, that was a major section of their activity. That, you know, the slashing of the tires. I mean, I'd like to tell you the story on all of that just pervaded the entire record in this case. There's no doubt about it. There's a paucity, really, of evidence that when he's in the treatment room, he's not behaving well. So I'm kind of general, I guess, in my answer to Your Honor's question, but clearly the outcome when measured by the record and all that was brought in to taint this, he was charged with domestic assault, totally dismissed. Alcohol, drugs, slashing tires, hot tub. It's all in this record, and it had to have affected their judgment. So, thanks a lot for your patience with us today. We're grateful for your service. Is there anything else that I...
Questions? I don't think so.
Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. The case was well presented. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory period.